In 1974, Francis Ford Coppola released The Conversation starring Gene Hackman. I first saw the picture in 1999 as part of my university degree course, projected on 35mm, and exited the showroom cinema in Sheffield in a daze. I was only 19 and thought I'd seen all I needed to see of Francis Ford Coppola, the Godfather films and of course Apocalypse Now. But boy, was I wrong. And was it me? Or did the world seem all a bit more frightening for a brief few hours after I walked out of that cinema? Fast forward to 2025, and we live in a world in which we are recorded, catalogued and targeted by bots, with every single app we download politely asking us if we mind it tracking us. Today, the conversation seems even more relevant than ever. And in this episode, I'm going to dive into Francis Ford Coppola's masterpiece about surveillance, guilt and the loneliness of modern life.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issue of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
The year is 1974. America, bloodied and humiliated by the war in Vietnam, and now entering the Watergate era in which President Nixon would resign over the scandal, was a country where its public had become all too aware that the nation they lived in now lied, deceived, and surveilled them. The idea that government could be listening was no longer some paranoid fantasy of lonely conspiracy theorists. It was, it seemed, now fact. Fresh from the success of The Godfather, Francis Ford Coppola went back to a project he originally began working on in the 1960s. It was to be his take on Michelangelo Antonioni's blow-up and focus on a professional eavesdropper, Harry Kuhl, played of course by Gene Hackman, who is perhaps the best in the business, a man who can record anyone, anywhere, worshipped by his peers as a genius. Harry is a man harbouring dark secrets. He is riddled with guilt, trusts no one, and lives a life of almost constant paranoia.
Well, I want to go over to my place and start, you know, getting it off, because I'm just tired of this all, you know.
That was terrible.
Yeah. Did you ever take ballet?
Weak ankles. Do you have a quarter for them?
The conversation begins with a slow zoom across San Francisco's Union Square. We have no idea who we're watching or why. But already, the slow zoom has made us feel complicit. The camera is moving deliberately. We are at this point with Harry Kuhl, watching from afar, trying to hone in on a particular conversation. The microphones Harry has planted around the square pick up random noises, which we will filter out. Laughter, footsteps, the sound of vehicles. And then we hear the line that will define the film and change our understanding of it as the narrative unravels.
He'd kill us if he got the chance. Kill us if he got the chance.
That line is relatively simple, but it's not what being said that matters. It's how it's being heard. Because The Conversation is a film about that uncertainty, about how technology gives us access to information, but in this case, not necessarily the truth. Harry Kuhl, played with calculating precision by Gene Hackman, is the perfect listener in a world that never stops speaking. He's a man who can uncover any secret but cannot survive intimacy. His work has made this everyman incredibly powerful, but it has also made him utterly alone. In this episode, I'm going to explore the conversation through its key themes and scenes, including how surveillance became a metaphor for the collapse of privacy in the 1970s, how guilt and religion haunt Harry's every silence, and how Coppola turns the pleasure of watching into something deeply unsettling. For Harry Kuhl, listening isn't just a job. It's a form of control, and control is the only thing keeping him from falling apart. And in the conversation, Francis Ford Coppola takes something mechanical, the act of surveillance, and turns it into a metaphor for his character's conscience. Harry doesn't just record people, he absorbs them. Every word he captured, every sound he isolates becomes another fragment of the guilt he cannot wash away. Cinema has always been a kind of voyeurism, a way of looking without being seen, but in the conversation, the pleasure curdles. Coppola and sound designer Walter Murch make us feel discomfort of watching. We're forced to listen closely, to strain our ears, to become complicit in Harry's intrusion. And the camera doesn't just observe, it stalks. It watches Harry as he watches others, folding us into the same web of surveillance. And the question becomes, to a degree, are we actually any different from him? The act of looking itself becomes toxic, an addiction that promises knowledge but delivers only anxiety.
What do you think? I don't know what I'm going to get him for Christmas yet. He's already got everything.
Harry, are you going to give me a hard time tonight?
Harry!
Harry! Back! Turn it off.
Frightened.
What do you think?
So she's just frightened.
I don't know what I'm gonna get him for Christmas.
It's no ordinary conversation.
Doesn't need anything anymore.
It makes me feel.
Well, I haven't decided what I'm gonna get you yet.
Something.
Forget it, Harry. It's only a trick.
What?
A job. You're not supposed to feel anything about it.
What about me?
You're just supposed to do it. That's all.
Paranoia in the 1970s wasn't just a mood of or feeling, it was to a degree a worldview that many had, and the conversation captures it perfectly. Harry lives behind locks and alarms, behind curtains and codes. He keeps his personal life sealed tight, as though privacy itself is something sacred. Yet the tighter he seals it, the more it leaks. There's a moment when he visits his girlfriend, Amy, and she's frustrated. He won't tell her where he lives, what he does, or who he is. He wants intimacy, but only on his terms, observed, recorded, and controlled. And that ultimately is the tragedy of Harry Kuhl. His paranoia isn't protection, it's a kind of punishment. He's built a life so private that no one else can enter, not even himself. And I think it's worth it just taking a little bit of time out to talk about one of perhaps a slightly more overlooked area of Harry Kuhl, and that's the trench coat that he wears, because it's not just a part of his costume. There's a sense that this is kind of his armour, because throughout the conversation, his layers of clothing function as a visual metaphor for privacy, guilt, and detachment. And although, of course, the coat serves a practical purpose, it's kind of the uniform of the surveillance man, a kind of professional disguise that blends them into crowds. But it's also a psychological shield. Beneath its heavy, shapeless fabric, Harry hides his vulnerability and the fear of exposure. It's a garment designed not for comfort, but for invisibility, a kind of cloak against intimacy. And Copland costume designer Aggie Rogers used texture and colour deliberately. The beige trench paired with the muted tones drains him of individuality. His clothes seem to absorb the light rather than reflect it. And I think this is mirroring his effort to erase himself from the world he observed. Even indoors, he often keeps his coat on, as if undressing will make him visible or worse, known to someone. And by the film's end, the coat has become symbolic of the spiritual suffocation that he's been going through. It's a monk's habit without faith, an emblem of self-imposed isolation. And when Harry removes it, even momentarily, he appears smaller, almost unprotected, although as if when he's wearing it, as though his guilt and paranoia can finally get through to him. In essence, it's not a coat that he just wears. It is really part of who he is, a warped layer of secrecy, along a man wrapped in a layer, longing for connection, but terrified at the same time of the exposure it will cause.
I've been involved in some work that I think will be used to hurt these two young people. This happened to me before. People were hurt because of my work. I'm afraid it could happen again, and I was in no way responsible. I'm not responsible. For these and all my sins of my past life, I'm heartily sorry.
And it brings me on to the themes of guilt and religion in the conversation, because guilt runs through the film constantly. It's not just professional guilt, it's moral, almost spiritual. Harry is a Catholic, though he barely speaks of it. He goes to confession, but it feels mechanical, though he's following a ritual without redemption. He tells the priest he's not responsible for what they do with the tapes. But this is a lie, and he knows it as well. His technology may separate him from the act, but it doesn't so from the consequence of what he's doing. Every time he presses record, he bears witness to something, and the weight of that witnessing is unbearable, like a man haunted by a sin that he simply cannot name.
He'd kill us if he got the chance. Kill us if he got the chance.
One of the most brilliant tricks that The Conversation plays is on us, the audience. We hear the same line, he'd kill us if he got the chance, again and again. And each repetition sounds the same, but its meaning shifts. At first, it sounds like a warning, the couple is in danger. But by the end, we realise it's the opposite. It's a threat from the victims to their supposed aggressor. The film forces us to confront how fragile perception is, how easily we project our own fears onto the information that we gather. Harry isn't just mishearing the recording, he's mishearing the world. And that's the quiet revelation of the film. The real danger isn't being watched, it's misunderstanding what we see. And when the truth finally breaks through, Harry tears his apartment to pieces. The walls, the floorboards, the pipes, all dismantled, searching for a hidden bug that may not even exist. It is, I think, one of the great images in American cinema, a man destroying his sanctuary piece by piece until there's nothing left to hide behind. The more he looks for the source of his surveillance, the clearer it becomes that it isn't coming from outside. It's inside him, the voice of guilt, of paranoia and of loneliness. He sits in the ruins, cradling his saxophone, playing the only honest sound he has left.
Thank you.
reflect, however, on the true, I think, star of the conversation. Yes, I think this is one of France. Yes, I think this is one of Gene Hackman's best performances. And I also think the supporting cast as well, the excellent John Cazale. And it's always so sad when you've watched films with John Cazale, because I can't think of a bad performance of a bad film he is in. He's a fantastic character actor, and I absolutely love him as Stanley in this. But I think the real star of The Conversation has to be Francis Ford Coppola. And this is a true, I think, auteurist film in the truest sense. He was both the writer and the director and the producer on it. And coming between The Godfather and The Godfather Part Two, I think it's definitely one of the most introspective films of his entire career. A film that trades a kind of grandeur that I think we come to know him as, especially when you think of the recent Megalopolis. Certainly springs to mind when I think of that. But instead, he goes for something far more earthy, and where the gangster epics explode outward, The Conversation is most certainly an inward film. It uses language of cinema to explore the act of perception and the moral limits of observation. And I'm going to be expanding some of the things I've already spoken about, but I think it's kind of interesting to do it through the kind of the lens of Francis Ford Coppola's direction. Because at its core, I think, he constructs a film that is about filmmaking. In fact, I think more so about editing in particular, the kind of the manipulation of fragments into meaning. And as someone who kind of works in this kind of realm, it's really interesting, because sometimes I have to kind of work on projects which are quite political. And I know I have created lies. I have created cutaways to people smiling and laughing that simply weren't happening in the room. I have made people look better than they actually are. I have removed things they said for their own reputation. I am part, I suppose, of a lie, which only kind of cinema can do. But I think it's, you know, Harry Cole isn't just a surveillance expert in the regard that we see him in the film. He is also an editor. His workshop is filled with tape decks and sliders and headphones. It has, for all intents and purposes, the look of a miniature film studio. The reels he splices, rewinds, and he filters his rushes. And the truth is, he seeks buried is in the noise between the cuts. And in this way, I think Coppola transforms a thriller into a kind of cinematic meta meditation. The film's central question, what really happened, is the same question every filmmaker asks when assembling images and sounds into a narrative cohesive whole. Walter Murch's sound design reinforces this mirroring. The repetition of the played line, "He'd kill us if he got the chance," becomes both an oral motif and an editorial obsession. Each playback is a new draft of this film, a new interpretation, a reminder that truth in film, as in surveillance, is always constructed. Harry doesn't uncover reality, he creates it, editing to what he believes what he wants to hear. In this, Coppola uses the machinery of cinema to comment on his own ethical ambiguity. The microphone becomes a camera, the reel-to-reel moviola, and Harry, the auteur, who can no longer trust his own cut. Coppola and cinematographer Bill Butler build this world through distance and distortion. The film opens with a telephoto zoom that glides slowly over San Francisco's Union Square, its long lens flattening perspective and compressing the crowd. We watch people more like insects in a petri dish, the image shimmering with optical unease. The choice of lens, long, voyeuristic, and alienating, established the film's central grammar. The camera itself behaves like a surveillance device. And throughout the film, Coppola alternates between those detached observational shots and claustrophobic close-ups of Harry. The long lens creates the illusions of omniscience, as if we, like Harry, can see everything. But the tighter shots remind us of his confinements, his inability to escape his own point of view. The result is a visual language that both mimics and critiques the act of surveillance. We see too much and understand little simultaneously. In moments where other directors might move the camera quickly, Coppola lingers. The camera holds on doorways, on curtains, on Harry's impassive face. The visual rhythm feels measured, almost weary, as if the film itself has become a reluctant interluder. This restraint turns space into tension. Instead of quick cuts and chases, Coppola gives us a quiet, suffocating tempo. Every gesture, every pause feels loaded with a potential for revelation or betrayal. And it's so in keeping with the film's sense of guilt. The tension doesn't come from action, but from waiting, from the slow accumulation of anxiety as we like Harry circled the same evidence, looking for meaning that may or may not exist. And Coppola draws suspense, not from what is hidden, but from what is over-examined. The film's editing rhythm mirrors Harry's psychological descent, controlled at first, increasingly fragmented as paranoia sets in. And this deliberate pacing almost also mirrors and complements the analogue technology at the film's heart. The world of tapes and spools is physical, slow and imperfect. There's a sensual patience in watching Harry rewind, replay and filter. The human labour of love trying to perfect the imperfect. And Coppola makes us feel that time, forcing the viewer to inhibit the rhythms of obsession. Each pause, each scratch of tape becomes another beat of suspense. The slowness is not an absence of energy, but instead it's our concentration that is required. By refusing the acceleration typical of thrillers, Coppola builds an atmospheric of dread rather than excitement. The film's silences are not voids but intensities, spaces that we can hear the hum of guilt between the surface. And when violence finally arrives, it feels not like a climax but almost like a confession, the inevitable result of too much looking and too much understanding. Ultimately, The Conversation is Coppola's most self-reflective work. It interrogates the ethics of seeing, the same ethics that haunt filmmaking itself. Harry's paranoia mirrors the artist's fear, the act of observing others will expose something unbearable about oneself. His obsessive editing of the recording parallels Coppola's own process, endlessly refining, seeking clarity, and knowing that perfection only breeds ambiguity. Coppola uses cinema's tools, framing, sound, repetition, pacing, not to entertain but to unsettle us, and the viewer becomes complicit in Harold's moral blindness, seduced by the illusion of control that images and recordings promise. And I think it's really interesting, when I was watching A Conversation again just recently to prepare for this, we now have a scandal in which it seems that the BBC has re-edited a video of Donald Trump to make it sound like he's saying something that he isn't. And I thought, what a perfect way of illustrating, I suppose, the film's relevancy in terms of how we can construct realities through filmmaking that simply don't exist in order to reaffirm or delude people into thinking something that hasn't actually occurred. In 1974, The Conversation imagined a world where privacy could be stolen through microphones and wiretaps. And 50 years later, we've built the world. We've built that world ourselves. But now, we simply call it convenience. We carry our own listening devices in our pockets. We tell them our secrets, our locations, our desires. And unlike Harry Cole, we aren't being spied on in secret. We've actually volunteered for it. That's why I think The Conversation feels so pathetic, not because it predicted specific technologies, but because it understood the psychology of surveillance. The deeper truth is this: we don't just fear being watched, we actually crave it to a degree. To be seen, to be known, to be heard, even by machines. And I think that's the paradox of our digital age. Connection, exposure have become the same thing. We are all Harry Cole now, listening and being listened to, recording and being recorded, trying to draw boundaries in a world that no longer really believes in them. I think what I love about The Conversation too is I think it kind of sits quietly in Coppola's career is overshadowed by The Godfather and Apocalypse Now, yet I think it's the most intimate of Coppola's work. And you can see its echoes everywhere, from Blowout, Enemy of the State, to Her and Black Mirror. Every story about surveillance and guilt, every image of a person staring at a screen, desperate to make sense of what they've seen, is a shadow of Harry Caul. It's not the most uplifting of films, but I do go back to The Conversation almost probably once or twice a year. It's a film that I've owned on every single format imaginable, VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, and now even UHD. And I've seen it at the cinema twice now. And every time I show it to someone who's never seen it before, they always connect with it. Everyone always has a very strong reaction to it. And I think it is saying something. What does it mean to be alone? And perhaps slightly more unsettling, do we still want to be? So that's going to be it for this episode of the 24 Frames Cast. Let me know if you've seen the film. You can email me at 24framescast@gmail.com. I am virtually non-existent on Twitter or X or whatever it's called this week. I think I might be done with it. When I was going into doing this episode about The Conversation, I posted something online and on Twitter and I received an extremely bizarre private message, which I'm not going to go into the details of, but it certainly had me looking over my shoulder. So perhaps it is time to eventually say goodbye to that platform. Good news is, on the life front, things have calmed down quite considerably. So I'm going to be hopefully sticking to a more regular release schedule. So many thanks for listening as always, and I'll be in contact soon. Bye.